Get everything for your next project at Menards and save big money. We carry everything to help you breathe easier. Allergen air filters help prevent seasonal allergy symptoms and improve your indoor air quality by capturing microparticles while allowing maximum airflow. Save big on Allergen air filters when you shop at Menards. View the weekly flyer and all of our great deals happening this week on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey, everybody. This is a very special episode of Whiskey Neat. And I've got today the seventh generation master distiller with Beam, Frederick Booker No. III. I said that word. Frederick. Fred No is here. And I'm extremely honored to have him. On top of that, we've got Adam Harris, the national brand ambassador for Beam. He's actually a Houston native. I'm a big fan of his. He's been to a few of my events. He's a great guy, and I couldn't be happier to have them both here. It's definitely an honor. Before we begin on today's show, I want to cover a few sponsorship details from a few different brands and kind of just cover some important stuff. So bear with me on this. First and foremost, Culture Map. They're a big supporter of the show. I'm actually in the studio at Culture Map now as we speak. And they have something happening next week called their Tastemaker Awards. So for those of you who don't know but are native to Houston, Culture Map covers the entirety of Houston culture here locally. They do this in Austin and Dallas. It's a phenomenal media outlet, right? And they do their Tastemaker Awards every year where they feature food from Houston. Houston's food scene is exploding right now. It's phenomenal. So their event is a lot like a whiskey festival, but it's food. Just a ton of food. Check out the tickets. It's very reasonably priced. Next Wednesday, it'd be great to take the wife. It's a 21 and up event sponsored by Woodford Reserve, who also sponsors this show. Woodford Reserve sponsored this show, and they actually sent me something pretty interesting and unique, and that is their new Kentucky straight malt whiskey. They just added or are adding a new permanent addition to their line called the Woodford Reserve Kentucky Straight Malt Whiskey. And this particular product, as opposed to bourbon in which it's like 51% corn and secondary grains, that sort of thing, the primary ingredient is 51% malted barley. So it's a completely unique, softer, more rounded, kind of like a nutty, unique product that is coming to Texas, and that should be here in the fall. So 51% malted barley, 47% corn, 2% rye at a nice 90.4 proof offering, and it's the same price as their bourbon. So it's definitely worth picking up and trying out. I'm a big fan. So Woodford Reserve, Whiskey Neat, Culture Map, and lastly, the Houston Whiskey Social. So as many of you know, the Houston Whiskey Social is this massive festival that we do locally here in Houston. It is now in its third year. It's the largest whiskey festival in Texas. We feature 300 plus. I'm going to push it to 350 this year if I can. And we just added Al Young to the lineup. So Four Roses is a huge supporter of the event. This is the only event Four Roses participates in. We've added Al Young to the lineup, and he's going to be hosting a small dinner or a small tasting before the event of all 10 recipes that Four Roses has, all barrel picks, all cast strength, at around 4 o'clock the day of the event. So there are only 40 spots available, and you can find those tickets on Eventbrite as well. So you've got the Four Roses tasting at 4, which is a separate ticket, the main event the evening at 6, HoustonWhiskeySocial.com. Definitely check it out. Without further ado, Fred No and Adam Harris. Thanks for coming, guys. Let's start pouring. What do you want to talk about? Let's talk about Distiller's Cut.
Yep. Yeah, Distiller's Cut, you know, is one we released last fall. It's non-seal filtered, barley 100 proof. This one, you know, is to give the bigger flavor. You know, seal filtration, when proof started reducing, they started chill filtering to keep it good and clean and crisp looking in the bottle. But when you chill filter, you remove solids, and solids is flavor. So,
you know, there's a big debate with that with a lot of Scotch drinkers. A lot of them say that there's no difference, and some of them argue. I agree. Anytime you're stripping anything from a spirit, the beauty of this hobby is getting a raw product from the barrel. I mean, just nature, thyme, and oak. Just, it's such a raw, why strip it? Raw, beautiful mm-hmm. product. And that's what makes it so much fun, is being able to taste this little golden, viscous, gorgeous nectar from a barrel. Most people prefer non-chill filtered, at least from my
right.
experience.
Yeah, it's bigger flavor. I mean, and flavor is there when you look at it, the nose, you know, and then when you taste it, you know, it.
And this is one of those things that you guys really didn't have to come out with. I mean, Jim Beam White Label and Jim Beam Black are some of the most highest selling bourbons in the world. I think you had mentioned last night at mm-hmm. at
yeah, Jim Beam White's the number one selling bourbon in the world.
10 million cases last year.
Should be there this year.
I mean,
should
that's
get there this year.
10 million cases. Anytime you're saying millions of cases, it makes me kind of shrink, because I get proud of when our local group can move 100 cases or something, and in the grand scheme of things, like, why do we even pay attention to us? Like, it's just 10 million cases. You guys are doing it.
It's worldwide, though. You know, it's a big market. You start looking at the whole world.
Well, you had said last night, if you're not making money now, it's only going to go downhill from here. Like, there's no, you're at the peak. We're.
Oh, I would say, yeah. If you're not making money now in the bourbon business, you better close the door, because, you know, if it's the market is wide open,
and it's booming.
Days. Yeah.
Oh, it's doing well. Everybody. I mean, I don't know of anybody that's not doing well in the bourbon industry right now.
Well, and we had also talked last night about in the older days, just a few years ago, that extra barrels would get sold to, you know, sold off to brokers. Now there's not enough to keep up with. So
right.
you're not really selling excess, because there is no excess. Right now you're trying to plan for the future, and you can't keep up with it. So it's
right. You know, the demand curve is off the charts right now. For bourbon anyway.
And this is what, 18 bucks? 19, 20 bucks?
About it, yep.
I mean, the biggest, I'd say the biggest difference between scotch drinkers and bourbon drinkers is price point, really. And I know that there's a difference in preference of flavors and that sort of thing, but with bourbons, you can get a great daily drinker, a great, awesome bourbon. You can, like, something that you, I don't know if you smoke cigars at all.
Little.
So the first cigar that I fell in love with was Rocky Patel's Vintage 1990, which is, and looking back on it, is not this amazingly expensive stick, but that was the first stick that I developed an emotional, like, okay, I'm into cigars. Yes. And with bourbon, you can have that in a $20 bottle as opposed to a $60 bottle of scotch. And really, there are a few, like, $30, $40 bottles of scotch, but the stuff that really makes the impact is definitely usually around the $50, $60 mark. So it's just a third of the price for a perfect natural product that's, yep, you know, no complaints.
I think one of the misconceptions that continue to come up, even while people are becoming more and more educated on bourbon and whiskey and becoming, you know, those novices are becoming enthusiasts and connoisseurs, people still tend to hold price and age at a certain, you know, reverence. Whereas, like you just said, you can get great whiskey that you would want to be completely happy to drink for the rest of your life at less than $20 a bottle if you're finding the right one, you know.
Well, there's several sides of it. So some people, you're absolutely right. I know several guys who are all about projecting a certain image, and they're proud of the $1,000 bottle of scotch that they bought. Whereas others do bottle comparisons to other stuff. You know, a good sourced whiskey nowadays, $50-$60. When you go direct to the source for $20, it's kind of, you're doing that bottle price comparison. Like, why would I go here when I can go here?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right. I think a lot of you just got to get out there and taste around and find what suits your palate and your pocketbook too, you know, because what you're going to drink daily will be something.
I said this in the last podcast. Whiskey debt is a real thing. You get it. you get into this hobby, you find yourself infatuated with trying new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And,
oh, yeah.
And bourbon's no exception. Even within the Beam line itself, there's such a vast difference in flavor profiles between some of your products, it's hard not to want to own or try literally everything you come out with. You
yeah.
know what I mean? At least at some point in your life.
I wanted to,
on top of just reveling in the fact that you're here, talk about a few things. You guys just filled, we talked about 10 million cases this year projected. You guys just filled your 15th million millionth barrel of Beam.
Since Prohibition, yeah.
That's, do you know where that ranks in fathomability of other brands? I mean, are you guys 15 million?
As far as bourbon, we've got more, we've done more barrels than anybody since Prohibition.
15 million barrels. Mm-hmm. That's just absolutely insane. Oh, and actually, it's funny that, okay, that just reminded me of something. There was a question I wanted to ask you. And did I ask you this last night about the American whiskey? So I wanted your input on innovation, maybe perception of cutting corners, that sort of thing. I found out that there's a distiller that is sourcing whiskey, which is fine. There's no problem with right. that. But they're sourcing whiskey that's aged in used barrels, which means it's not bourbon, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And can't be a bourbon if it's in a used barrel.
If it's used in a... Okay, right. So correct. I went back and looked at the regulations on this, and I know there we're going to have some listeners that are going to love this. It says it has to be stored in a charred new oak container, mm-hmm. right? Doesn't have to be American oak.
Right.
Doesn't have to be a barrel.
Doesn't even have to be a barrel. It could be a box. That's correct. So it doesn't say exclusively stored. So we found out... That I say we, it's me. Mm-hmm. I found out.
The royal we.
So they're purchasing, sourcing product from used barrels, which is American whiskey, right? Once it's gone from a new barrel, once you age it in a used barrel, it becomes American whiskey, no longer bourbon. Then they're finishing it in a brand new oak barrel. They're dumping it into a brand new charred oak barrel, aging it for 6 months or a year or however long, and then bottling it as bourbon. And that's something that I don't think many people have ever even thought of doing.
No, that's kind of wild.
So I just, and I say I found out. I'm not sure if this is actually the case, but I'm just curious if you have any insight. If that, well, it had caught me so off guard because no one's really thought about that sort of thing. Because right. I know the Finnish thing, when Finnish bourbons came out, right? Sherry cask mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And
Makers. We do some of that. Yeah.
Makers makes a phenomenal 46 with the French oak staves. Mm-hmm. And actually met Bill Samuels not too long ago. And I guess, would it be junior or senior?
Junior.
The older one. And he explained the same thing. He explained the process. It's still, you know, as long as you say that it's finished in this and finished in that, then it could say bourbon on the label. And I just thought it was fascinating because I'd never heard of that. So I didn't know if that would still qualify as bourbon because I couldn't find anything disqualifying as bourbon.
So when we do finishes like that, we put on the label Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey finished in whatever.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Because we start with stuff that's been aged in a new charred oak container.
And I think that's
every
the
time.
That, correct. And
every
I think
time.
That's what, so I think know. That's the instinct is yeah. always charred new oak from the get-go. Mm-hmm. But I didn't see anything disqualifying the idea, which brings to light the scenario that if enough, you know, if enough distillers realize that you can age and used first, then finish in new and still legally call it bourbon, then less American whiskeys would be sold because they'd rather have the word bourbon on the label, that sort of thing. It's an interesting.
I don't see the advantage of why you would use cooperage before going into an unused. Personally, I don't know what the taste advantage would be or the.
My first thought was the saving of barrel cost, but if you're finishing in a new barrel anyway, just to get the qualification, then you're still using a new barrel.
Right.
So
yeah.
I don't see them saving cost necessarily, but I just.
That's interesting. There, yeah. Don't know about that one.
Yeah, I wish there was like an ultimate because you can send inquiries to the TTB and that sort of thing.
Right.
And a lot of them, I don't think a lot of them really in America with our government, a Supreme Court makes a final judgment call. With bourbon, it's one of like whatever the if they just whoever the agent is assigned to a situation or whatever they'll sign off on something or whatever. But I wish there was like this ultimate source besides Google that
right.
you could get answers
yeah.
to questions
yeah.
like that, like a definitive. This is okay. This is not okay. Because otherwise,
that's kind of like a found loophole, though. That's an interpretation to not to be looking for the word exclusive and then not find the word exclusive is a little bit of a deliberate loophole, right?
I mean, right. And bourbon in general, there's lots of people trying to find new ways to innovate and trying to find new ways. The whole reason finished whiskeys came about was, well, and I don't know if this is true. So the way I understand it is in Scotland, used barrels are cheaper.
Yeah.
And so I from what I understand, when sherried whiskeys first came out, it wasn't so much to add that complexity, but it was like a discovered complexity. They used the barrels. It gave it some darker color or more, you know, dark, rich Christmas notes, that sort of thing. And then all of a sudden it was became so popular. Now bourbon has borrowed from that, and we do a lot of finished stuff. I think it's a loophole that I don't, a deliberate workaround where they definitely, but then again, I don't know. It's just, it's one of those things that it's such a conversational, I'd never even thought of it.
Nope.
Mm-hmm. So of course it adds a whole another level to the thought process behind bourbons.
I'm glad we haven't thought of that.
Yeah. Well, and I think some people will definitely pass judgment on that sort of thing. Anything you do in this industry is going to catch some feedback. So 15 million barrels, and you and your entire family's 8-generation legacy now being passed to your son, Freddie.
That's correct. Yep.
So Freddie's taken over the reins, or is taking over, working on taking over the reins. And he was here, I actually had tacos with him when he was here last. So they did something at April Flint locally. And, we did a deconstruction of his recent thing, little book.
Right.
Little book is an American whiskey again, but what he did I thought was genuinely creative. Yep. Where you guys, same typical mash bill for bourbon, just distilled separately, aged separately, then blended after the fact.
Right.
So that's again something that's never been done before, but it's definitely not cutting corners. That's a mm-hmm. extremely labor and cost extensive process, and you guys blended all the ingredients together and this beautiful dark box and gorgeous bottle. I mean, the Booker's bottles in general are some of the most stunning bottles on the market. And it's actually a very great whiskey. Like, I there's no complaints there. It's just an awesome product. You guys,
thank you. I'm glad he did well, I think.
8 generations, and you guys are still kind of innovating the trying new stuff, which is good.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of, especially in food, there's a lot of preference for tradition, refusing to change the way things were done. And as you can see, there's three products in front of me that all within the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. The 25th was from last year. Yeah.
Right.
So it's a company steeped in history, 8 generations, while still trying a lot of open-minded stuff. It's
very bright future, you know, to go with our historical
past.
You know, past, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, Freddie, he's young and looks at things a little differently than different set of eyes than me and previous generations. So when he came up with the idea, they thought, let him try it. And
it worked.
Very well.
It worked very well.
And he's, you know, now the challenge will be coming up with a unique blend every year because it's never going to be repeated. That's his goal, is to come up with something with a unique taste profile.
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
But one thing about it, with the Beam Suntory streams of spirits, he's got an open canvas. If you think about all the different spirits that are at his disposal, from, you know, the bourbon side to our Canadian side, then we've got our Scotch side, we've got our Irish side, Japanese whiskeys. I mean, if he really gets creative, and he could even, you know, God forbid, or maybe if he does, you got rum, tequila. I mean, you look at it, cognac.
Little book 1 year.
I mean, you never know what he can. And so, they have pretty much given him the green light.
Carte blanche to do what he needs to do.
To, you know, explore whatever and go places that nobody's gone before. So who knows what he'll come up with.
Le Petit Book finished in a cognac.
Yeah, yeah.
Who knows? I mean, I'm not going to say it won't happen because, you know.
You bring up a question. You bring up, you said, so you guys, in Little Book is a breakdown of single malt, corn whiskey, a really really good corn whiskey, by the way.
13-year-old corn whiskey.
So I had tasted that corn whiskey at the deconstruction, and I thought on its own you guys could make a ton of money on it. It was just absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. The corn whiskey, 4-year-old bourbon, and some rye. Question is, and if you can't answer it, I completely understand. Do you guys have any other grained whiskeys that you guys are aging in the warehouses besides corn, malt, rye, and bourbon?
We got some other stuff we've played with that's, you know, laying down.
There's a distillery up there in Kentucky that's aging, and I don't know how, but from what I understand, hemp is a grain, and they've got a barrel of hemp whiskey aging in their warehouse, and it is unique.
I bet.
But I couldn't, you know, I just wasn't sure. I guess you guys are, because you guys had that series.
It's like probable cause calls going out to that distillery every day.
Well, that's why I didn't mention their name. But you guys had that release, was it 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
Harvest Collection.
The Harvest Collection. Yeah. Right. So there's quite a bit of few things.
Yeah, we've done played with other grains, you know, brown rice, triticale. You know, we're a couple of ones that were different. We're bourbon based.
Right.
It was corn.
It's all corn, yeah.
And so, you know, we play with other grains. Getting them through the system and, you know, making it work is the trick.
You made those with your dad, right?
Made them right when dad was on his, towards the end of his life.
Yeah.
Come a little closer to the mic.
Oh, sure.
No worries. All right, so, and I could be wrong, if I'm wrong, but what's your favorite of the line? What do you drink every day?
Well, I drink, bounce around, you know. If I've got to do much speaking, I stay away from the bookers.
Yeah.
But Jim Beam Black is one that I drink quite a bit, you know, day to day.
That's what I had heard. I heard that Black was your go-to. That's what we had last night with some Black.
And, you know, I do a little Knob Creek and, you know, bookers if I'm close to home. Basil Hayden occasionally, you know, on the rocks.
I'm a big Knob Creek fan. We've done a few barrels. We mentioned that last night. Mm-hmm. Specifically with those individual barrels, you can really range in, you know, really you can find some off-profile stuff, really interesting stuff. But Black's the 8-year-old was when I first got into bourbon, moving from Scotch, because I started with Scotch. I was a big Scotch guy.
Right.
With some of my 8-year-old bourbon for nothing, less than $20. I mean, just
great value,
incredible
good
value.
Whiskey,
yeah. And it's good whiskey. And this is. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but the bump in proof on the distiller's cut is just another step above.
Correct.
You're pushing that market of people who prefer a little bit more. So
a little more flavor, yeah, a little more finish. And that's what I think a lot of whiskey drinkers and especially bourbon drinkers, they like, you know, what bourbon's all about. And big nose, you know, they enjoy smelling it, tasting it in the finish after they swallow it. You know, it's got to have everything.
Of course, yeah. It's I'm a big nose. The thing that initially gets me specifically with bourbon is the nose. When I smell a glass, especially like in something like this, that just once you acclimate to nosing past that burn of alcohol and really picking up those the wood notes, the oak sweet sugar bomb that bourbon is, it's I think that's where you first start falling in love with the idea of bourbon. I mean. When I got into bourbon, American palates, I think the reason why bourbon is so popular is because we're such sugar mongers. We love our sugars. The U.S. palate or the American palate's all sweets, right? And bourbon is just sugar for days. I mean,
correct.
Maple syrup, you know, it's just those typical flavors. Mm-hmm. And if you can get that for under $20, I mean, it's a win-win.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good one. I mean, this is a great product, I think.
Do you drink it straight?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't.
Or add a splash of water sometimes. Just depends. Depends on the time of the year. If it's cooler, less water, warmer, more water, maybe a cube or two of ice.
Yeah, when it gets real hot, I think a little ice wouldn't hurt you. So Fred's legacy, 8 generations.
How many barrels when you're doing the million barrel lap or landmark, how many of those millions have you seen under your purview or while you were
your reign?
Yeah,
your reign of terror.
Yeah, I mean, the first one we really did a ceremony on was the 8 millionth with dad, and so 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Wow. And the 10th was what, 2012?
I feel like we were doing a million every year and a half years, almost.
Right? Actually, no, 2005, you filled the 10 millionth barrel of Jim Beam, and now we're at 15. So
about every 2 years now.
Yeah.
So you...
It's a good clip.
Yeah.
Real good clip.
That means that you've been at the... Since you've been with the company, you've been through most of the majority of the barrels. Like you've been in... You being at the company for the majority of its bourbon... distribution sort of thing. Does that, I'm not quite finding the right.
I never really thought about it like that, but yeah.
But meaning you've been there the majority of what you guys have done as a company, the impact you've had on the world, which is something that a lot of people can't say. I mean, an impact on the globe. And I mean, in Japan, bourbon's huge. Right?
Oh, yeah.
And that's been the focus for many years.
It's doing very well.
My dream's to bring it more back stateside. You guys have an audience here, and it does seem like you know some of. I know Wild Turkey sends a lot of great stuff over to Japan. It's mm-hmm. But we still find it. You know, yeah. As Americans, we find our ways to get to it. You know, where there's a will, there's a way. So, in fact, there's a guy locally who he's a captain of a shipping ship. Is that the right word? Shipping ship, a ship that ships
sure
containers. And he
cargo ship.
Okay. There it is. So he spends most of his time in Southeast Asia picking up whatever he can. He comes back with some really nice stuff that we just can't get here. You know,
and, right?
It's something that as you guys build up stocks and grow, and we continue to follow this train, I think the focus will be more American. You know. Hopefully come back to more American focus with some of the neater stuff, you know, that sort of thing.
A lot of our, you know, more exclusive brands, for example, the Booker's Rye was U.S. only.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
So, you know, the Knob Creek 25th, U.S. only. So we kind of release it here and then it trickles out overseas.
Yeah, the other way around. I guess it's a little bit of give and take for depending on the...
Yeah, depending on your, you know, we see our demand here in the U.S. is, you know, we kind of let it get here and then... Let the world figure out a way to get here to get it, then us
the other
sell
way
it somewhere else and make it come back here.
That's just that's awesome. Oh, it's 10 a.m. and I'm having drinks with Fred now.
Life's good.
So I guess would we move to the 25th next?
It's whatever you.
I think that'd be a good move.
Hey, yeah, we finished with the rye, absolutely. So tell me about the 25th.
Well, we wanted to celebrate 25 years of Knob Creek, which, you know, was a recent milestone for us. I mean, this is a brand that I pretty much watched come to life, you know, while I was in my early years at Beam and did quite a bit of work promoting the Knob Creek brand. And so, you know, doing something on the 25th anniversary, we thought we'd do something special, and I actually tasted every barrel. That we did for people that got
the anniversary. What was the count, the barrel count for the 25th anniversary? How many barrels did you guys?
We did 16 barrels for 16 of the best accounts in the country, and they got a barrel. And I tasted every barrel.
Every one of them.
It.
Yeah.
Tough job. Somebody had to do it. Yeah. But it was an interesting adventure. We would do it in the mornings. We didn't do all 16. One time, but it made for a nice day. You know, the first thing you do is taste these barrels, each a sample from each individual barrel. People think that we taste every barrel on all the stuff. I said, no, we don't.
Yeah.
Usually we'll taste one barrel out of a particular lot, you know, which is one production date. But on this particular product, we actually had a small sample from every barrel and either got thumbs up, thumbs down. There was no thumbs down, but.
Yeah, they were all worth it.
It was fun. We had a couple folks out of the lab, and then Grant Wheeler, who works our Knob Creek single barrel program and takes customers into the warehouse and lets them do the experience with him. He was there, so we'd go in the lab in the mornings and start off, do a few, then laugh the rest of the day.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's a good day.
So what – and this is something a lot of – and we had mentioned this before. When you taste – so my understanding is, you know, the whiskey community loves, and I've mentioned this to a few people locally, whiskey community, as you go through your bourbon journey, you tend to move up in proof. Mm-hmm. But from what I understand, a lot of master distillers, when they're going through tasting, will cut it down to 60 proof so that they don't so they don't blow their palate out, and, and you're tasting through X amount of samples a day, kind of, you know, one, it kind of takes its toll, alcohol's notorious effect. And then on top of that, it kind of blows your, you know, burns your mouth out. So I was going to ask you, when you go through and taste like those samples, did you do it straight?
I did them all straight, and then we cut it second.
Okay.
But now I didn't take huge drinks, you know.
Yeah, yeah, just a little sip.
I like a little sip of it neat just to get the full effect, get the finish, get everything about it, and then cut it a little bit just to see, you know, what it's going to do if somebody puts it on a rock or something.
Yeah.
Because the person that drinks it neat, it's going to be just like it is there. Somebody may puts in a puts it on a rock.
It's going to change it completely.
Adds a little splash of water. It will change. Opens it up, changes the taste profile drastically.
Barrel programs a lot will, when you come to the distillery, you're tasting stuff at cask strength.
Correct.
And a lot of times it'll be bottled at a cut proof.
Right. We cut everything on our Knob Creek to a flat 120.
Yeah, which is still a healthy 120. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know of another 120 program out there besides Knob Creek. I think Reserve does, Russell's Reserve does 115. You guys are still a healthy 120s, definitely might as well be barrel strength.
Pretty close. If you get a barrel, it's, you know, 124, 125. You're not putting a lot of water in it.
Right.
You know, some people get those ones that are 135, 136. It will change
a lot.
A lot. But now, a lot of the folks that are picking barrels tend to pick them closer to the barrels, to the bottle strength, so it doesn't change much.
A lot of these barrel picking groups and clubs and what have you, I think, have picked up on that, because they'll actually take some water with them into the warehouse and kind of taste it straight, but also add a little dash here or there just to kind of taste it.
Oh, yeah. We got water up there, too, for them.
To project what it's going to look like
exactly
in the bottle.
I think we'd be remiss not to mention that one of the barrels that Fred did select of those 16 resides here in Houston.
That's it's the only one in Houston.
That's
so
right.
When this came out, I just thought it was a limited release, but and Morgan Weber, the way we're tracking now, he gets mentioned every episode. but A. Roflant here in Houston got the only barrel in Houston, and then there was one other in Dallas, right?
Correct.
So two in Texas. One of them resides here in Houston at A. Roflant, and I think some of it kind of leaked over to Houston Wine Merchant on purpose. He released it, but if you're definitely interested, the Knob Creek 25th, the only one you can get in Houston is at Houston Wine Merchant or A. Roflant. I know for sure it's there for at least serving.
Yep.
So Morgan is, for those who
had some at Night Heron over the weekend, actually.
Is that place open yet?
Yeah, it's very nice.
So for that, for those who don't know, I say that every episode, Morgan is part of a group called the Houston Bourbon Consortium. So him and Chris Shepard and I don't know the third guy, Kevin.
Yep.
And they go and they pick barrels, and I assume they had their hand in that.
Yep.
As well as the very first Knob Creek rye for the state. So when's that supposed to be here?
Shortly, because they did it towards the end of the year, so it should be coming online any minute, I would say, with about a two, three month turnaround.
I have yet to try a Knob Creek rye barrel pick, so I'm excited to give that a shot.
And this one, you know, unique thing that we didn't really mention, this is bottled at cask strength.
That's right.
So, you know, this is there's no water added to this one at all. And it also is much older. You know, this particular one was laid down May 13th of 2004. So it was right at 13 years old.
Wow.
When it was bottled. So
we actually just picked a Knob Creek barrel that was just shy of 14 years.
That first one we did, or
no? The first one we did, I actually never got the age on the first one, but or didn't remember the age from that night. But we just did one back in September for one of our fall dinners, and it was 13 years, 10 months, and definitely off profile from your typical beautiful bold Knob Creek. It was very unique. Out of the three samples, one of them was almost 15 years, and that one was just a little too oaky. We like that 13-year, 10-month one right in there, but it would have been nice to see it right at 14. You know, just that little nerd in me wants to see it. You shouldn't judge a a whiskey by its age for sure, but part of you just wants to see it push over that little, you know, right around 14. But it's great.
What's your age sweet spot?
I think anywhere from 9 to 12, 13, you're hitting in a sweet spot. Anything, to me, if it gets too woody, you can tell when, you know, it's almost like adding salt or pepper.
Too much.
To something you're cooking. You can get too much wood. And, you know, where it's stored in the rack house greatly affects that. I mean, you can put barrels down low, and if the number on the bottle is a big thing, lower storage whiskey takes longer to get there, where higher storage gets there quicker.
Right.
You know, so if you had a 14-year-old barrel from up close to the top of the warehouse, it would be so hot and woody
intense.
That it'd be very intense.
Might as well just chew the bar stool at that point.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's actually a whiskey that was released last year that I think it was 41 years old. It was a bourbon.
I saw that.
And we got it locally, and Pasha from Rosewater, again, he's been mentioned every episode, they did a break-even bottle just so you can experience it all. You know, a little bit of piece of history. 41 years old, you know, it was quite a ways back. So we did a break-even on it and tasted it, and it was all barrel. You know, this has got like this beautiful gold amber color. The nose on it was great. It actually smelled fantastic. But it was like wood tea. Like you had just been steeping wood shavings in a barrel for 41 years. I mean, it was intense.
Wood tea.
But it was fun. It was a fun experience. Like a lot of us enjoyed it, and it wasn't too expensive to experience it. And then you've got that story about that one time you tried the world's oldest bourbon, you know?
Yeah.
So it's part of what this is all about. Now, I don't think it started this way, but at least nowadays, I think as a consumer, it's all about the experience. You want to try something new. You want to experience something unique. Doesn't have to necessarily be rare, like 41 years old, but you know, there's three things in front of me here that are unique. This is unique to the brand, unique to Beam, and just fun. I mean, that book is right. It's a lot of fun. So
we'll get there. Don't worry.
Yeah, no rush.
I know you're looking at the end of this, but.
So where are you going to next? I think you had said you were about to hit the road.
Yeah, we're going to do a European market visit. We'll hit London and Germany and Italy and Vienna.
How does bourbon do in Europe?
It's doing well. It's doing very well.
I went and visited there a few years back, and I ran into the issue that a lot of people have when they travel. You put too many bottles in your bags. So we had to buy a new suitcase to check another bag.
Right.
And I told the guy at the airport shop that I needed another bag, and he goes, "What for?" And I said, "I'm bringing back some bourbon." And he goes, "What are you bringing back moonshine for? Take back some scotch." And I thought, there's this, I don't know if it's an American stereotype or what, but I don't think in some areas of the world, bourbon doesn't quite get the respect it deserves.
I think that's vastly improved, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just like you said, it's a
getting there.
It's been a growing market for sure, but a lot of this hobby in particular carries a lot of snobbery, right? Same thing with beer or wine, right? I remember that old film where California wines didn't get, what was it, Sideways?
Yeah.
Where California wines never got the respect they deserve until they went heads up blind against some of the European producers. And if you are a scotch drinker and you're listening to this, bourbon is a vast category that's worth your attention for sure.
Well, right? I think that when you think about Angel Share and you think about how much loss we get per year and how much loss they get over in Scotland, you know, it's almost 3-4% here, and then it's 1-2% over there. So if the Angels like bourbon better, then why shouldn't we?
In that case, then Texas bourbon is because we see quite a bit of loss here. I know Balcones had mentioned that sometimes after a few years they see something like 25% overall. It's just awful. That's a lot of waste.
Right. Well, but really, you know, when you lose it, it concentrates the flavor. So you'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And there's no complaints here. And in fact, you can arguably. There's no denying that, and I'm not trying to sales pitch this, but there's no denying that Beam is full of flavor. You guys have a very pronounced There's some bourbons out there that are great. There's no complaints, but the punch in the face that you get with something like a Knob Creek 120 is just so. The word robust comes to mind, where it's just like this really intense concentration of caramel and wood. It's something that, and the same thing with the rye. It's just a dark, some of the darkest juice I've. And I know some people hate calling it juice, but
it's okay.
Some of the darkest stuff I've seen is some Knob products.
I think when you have big flavor and robust flavors that come through in overproof spirits, if they're made right and treated well over the time that they're maturing, when you have something that comes out at a high proof, 125, 136, whatever it might be in that range, I think that the flavor is so, you know, delightful that you're not thinking about the proof that you're drinking. You're thinking about all this joy that you're getting from the flavor.
I think for the most part, if you've acclimated to higher proof, I agree. There's other people I've introduced to some higher proof bookers, and they're so caught off guard with the intensity that they're not used to drinking higher proof.
Right.
Well,
you
got to
climb the mountain. You know?
Yeah, it's a bit of an adjustment for sure. Right.
I mean, add a little water to it. I mean, Dad, the reason he started the uncut version of bourbon was to allow the consumer to cut it to the strength that they enjoy it at, because you know, everything we bottle, with the exception of this Knob Creek 25th and the Booker's line, we do cut with demineralized water down to the bottling strength. But he said, let the consumer cut it if they want to.
So I've been preaching that for a few years now, that I would much rather buy the Country Tide lemonade powder and water it down myself to the appropriate sweetness. Mm-hmm. I think that a higher proof product, so proof is tied directly to flavor.
Exactly.
And the cast strength, the way it comes out of the barrel, is the most flavor that product, the spirit, can have, right? That's the pinnacle. You adding water cuts it down, which is fine. Drink it how you want. But in my opinion, I think cast strength products are inherently better. Not necessarily inherently taste better, but it's a better value. It's a better experience, because then you have the control to find your sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, you can move up from there, right? So the first time I start, I may throw some Coke in there. The second time, you know, as you develop, you switch to ice, you switch to a few drops of water and a few less drops of water. You move up, like you said, you climb that mountain.
Mm-hmm.
A higher proof product, I just think, is inherently a not just a better value, but just a better long-term experience. With a high proof product, you don't have to move up, meaning you don't have to change the bottle. Right. So if you buy a product that's only a certain proof and it's always at that proof, you can move on to other spirits at a higher proof.
Yeah.
But with Booker's, all you have to do, same bottle. You never have to change the bottle. You never have to change the product. You can just start at the lower proof yourself by adding as much water as you want. Keep the same bottle. You don't have to move on to a new product and move up until you're drinking it neat. And that's exactly what we're doing, just a neat product.
I think it's one thing that Fred and I get to see at whiskey fests and whiskey events that we're pouring. You know, I think 10, 15 years ago, you were pouring more of the 80s, 90s, and nowadays everybody's going directly towards, you know, the Bakers and the Knob Creeks and the Knob Creek barrel, single barrels and Bookers all the time. I think we had to go down from trying to do 6 to 8 releases of Bookers a year. Now we can only really do 4 because we
want
to make sure that whiskey stays as special as it is, you know.
And you guys are still doing, how many barrels are in the batches of Bookers? About 300, that's what I thought. So mm-hmm. What's that produce?
It varies a little bit.
20,000 bottles? 30,000 bottles?
Ah, you won't get quite 30,000.
Especially at cash strength?
25, probably.
25?
Just depends on the yield.
What's the next one coming out?
We're looking at the next one's going to be in a few weeks. It's going to be Front Porch, I think.
Front Porch?
Or no, might be Backyard Barbecue.
Yeah.
We got a couple names for Dad's favorite things to do.
Well, the first one for 2018 hasn't really even seen
Kathleen's
Houston yet.
Yeah, we haven't even seen Kathleen's batch yet.
That's a pretty special bottle, I think.
It's named for Kathleen DiBenedetto, who was the brand manager of the small batch bourbons back in her infancy. She always called them her babies, and she helped build these brands.
Who
where they are today.
Who decides what the next batch is going to be?
We pick some names and then
play around with it.
And the brand team, and we just kind of sit and talk, and you know, we try to find a tie-in back to Dad somehow.
My favorite batch of 2017 was Tommy's batch. I liked that one quite a bit, the first one from last year.
That was actually
I love
a great
that one from Tom Croom. Yeah.
Thoroughly enjoyed that. Distiller who worked at the distillery with Booker and me and recently retired.
So, and speaking of Bookers in general, the next special release is this year, right? The 30th anniversary?
Yep. We're going to be our 30th anniversary of Booker's is coming up this year.
And is that going to be this fall?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll tell you, the 25th anniversary, up until recently, Pasha still had bottles on the shelf in his bar that were kind of tucked away. He had to know what to ask for. Some of the best. So historically, up until this bottle, the Booker's Rye, the anniversary bottle, the 25th, was the most gorgeous bottle of bourbon I had ever seen. Just that gold, copper wax, mm-hmm. the decoration on the bottle. And then, of course, when the rye came out, I was blown away by this, that dark green. We had talked last night, we don't know where the dark green rye came from, but it's now synonymous with rye, is that dark green color.
The million-dollar question, I think.
Right. Nobody really knows who started green rye. But yeah, think about that 25th anniversary. It was some 10-year-old Booker's. It was a little older. It was some of the last bourbon that Dad made before he passed away. So that made it a little special, too, and it had some different taste profiles than normal Booker's because it was aged longer.
From what I understand, there were actually two different batches of the 25th anniversary, right? There was
No, we just had one version of the 25th anniversary of Booker's. It was just one batch.
Okay. I don't remember exactly who told me that, but I would always understood that there was slightly different taste profiles. Mm-hmm. But you guys actually did something with the rye last year, right? I mean, after mm-hmm. Harvey, there was some sort of...
And we held back a few cases and, went on the release and we've just held them back. And then after the Harvey deal, we released them out and sold them and then gave 100% of the proceeds to the Harvey Relief.
That's incredible. I remember when stuff was held back and then they got released, I remember hearing it was for charity. I didn't realize it had all come to Houston.
We hadn't found a charity. We just held on to about 36 cases of it, and then
just found an
we
opportunity.
Waited and for the right time. And obviously, that was a very right time.
Oh my gosh, it was horrible.
Yeah.
It was actually the night of the famous Mayweather Conor McGregor fight, and it was my birthday, and I had people over, and it was raining. Didn't even realize what was about to happen over the next 2 days, and it just got demolished. We had family, and it was just a mess. And Kentucky just got some pretty bad flooding too, didn't they?
We had, the Ohio River got really, really high since, I guess, 1997 was the last time it was even close to that level.
Yeah.
And, it's great we can give back and give some, as we kind of say, growing for good, to give back to the community any way we can. So we try to find charities that we can help out with to give back to the, the community and anytime we do something, we're always looking for opportunities to help out.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of the Booker's Rye, let's get a fresh glass here.
Yeah.
Let's put something
freshened up. You want to do the honors there? I think Chris would probably appreciate having that poured
Being
by you.
Served by Fred, no.
Hey, one thing about the label on this one, they asked me to write the label since Dad handwrote the Booker labels. So I reluctantly agreed. Well, I normally print and then sign my name in cursive. Well, I printed the print that they wanted, sent it to our corporate headquarters, and they came back and said, "Can you do it in cursive?" And I said, "Oh, shit."
That's why the old Booker's label was handwritten in cursive.
Right.
Yeah.
And so after I don't know how many tries, I finally got the label written out in cursive. So that's kind of my handwriting, trying to mimic my father's style a little bit, but really just writing in cursive, I guess, is a lost art. My nine-year-old granddaughter, I thought maybe I could get some help from her.
They're not even teaching it in Texas schools
anymore.
Right. She looked at me like when I said cursive, I could have been saying cursing and she wouldn't know any difference.
She just wrote the F word on the bottle.
It would have been easier for her to cuss me out than to write in cursive, but... because how many humps are in an M, and when you go from an M to
an N, and
you don't think about it when we were doing it when we were in grade school, but I haven't written much like that in a long, long time.
You did a good job.
It was a challenge.
It's an absolutely stunning bottle. And I think the contrast of the gold on the green and that super dark liquid, I think you really did hit it out of the park.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chris. I mean, it was fun. I mean, we got to play with it and taste it. I was amazed at the balance for, you know, number one, a rye whiskey of this strength. You know, it doesn't light you up like
it's like 130-something, right? 136?
136.2. It was 13 years, 1 month, 12 days.
Jeez.
I mean, when you first started talking about doing it, I said, are you sure?
You could have taken that corn whiskey and done a Booker's batch of corn limited edition. I'm telling you, it was just... caught me off guard.
Corn whiskey's good.
Especially at that age. You don't see many corn whiskeys that age that long because most times people age corn out for a year at most.
A couple years.
Sometimes 90 days.
I think Heaven Hill's Mellow Corn is something like 4 years, something like that. Let me ask you this, and before we go, and we'll wrap up here. And if you can't give me a little insider secret, I totally understand, but is there anything coming down the pipeline that would get anyone excited besides the 30th anniversary, which I'm sure is going to be a blowout Booker's release? And even if it's something new, like this Distiller's Cut is just great, is there something?
I mean, I think Freddie's, you know, version of Little Book, the second version, he let me taste it. It's very tasty, and it's totally different.
From the first batch?
Oh, yeah. There's no similar...
anything about it?
Nothing, no. No components used in the first batch of Little Book are used in the second batch. He's leery of telling me much.
Of course.
Last year I got on a show kind of like this. It wasn't really a broadcast. It was a media interview. Fred Minnick was interviewing me for another project, and him and Freddie have been – Fred actually interviewed Freddie. I guess maybe it was his very first interview, being my son. You know, he was just coming into the industry. You know, what it's going to be like following your father's footsteps. Anyway, so he asked about him, and out of the blue, I didn't really think Fred was going to publish anything. I said, well, he's working on something. And what is it? I said, what's something I'm going to call? And I let the name Little Book out. But I didn't know the components or anything. But when Fred published it, Fred, Dad, you're not supposed to be talking about it. It's supposed to be a surprise because people in the company didn't even know it. You know, the people within Beam didn't even know Freddie was working on this project.
But I think that's the way, you know, historically press releases were a thing. I think people get emphatic and get passionate when you leak something, even if it's by purpose.
Oh, yeah.
The movie industry borrows from that, where they'll leak a trailer preview of something when it's leaked on purpose, really. They're trying to build
right. Yeah, I did. So this year, he has not given me any details whatsoever. I did taste it.
Yeah.
But he didn't.
It's good.
He wouldn't tell me. Oh, yeah, it's very good. And he thinks it's better than last year, and I tend to agree with him. So flavor-wise, now will it be received as well?
As well?
I don't know. Who knows?
I bet it will. I think Little Book was received so well that you've already got a leg up for this next one.
Because he's going in a place that, you know, for bourbon country, nobody's gone before. Yeah. So I think that's – and people want unique flavors.
Always.
I mean, that's the thing. You know, you want something different that you can pull out and say, well, taste this. Especially something you can turn your friends onto.
Of course.
If they've never seen it.
People always want to be the one to
right.
You know,
to be the one.
Did you hear what happened with this?
Yeah. Did you ever? You know the story on this?
Yeah. So there's that old saying. You know, the only way for three people to keep a secret is if you kill two of them.
Right.
So it's you gotta keep it quiet. So, well, I'm excited. That Little Book, I really don't see how you could go wrong.
He's having fun with it.
With
you
such
know,
a leg up on it,
honoring his grandfather, and you know, because that's what Dad called him, the Little Book. And you know, doing it cast strength. That's another thing that he's.
I'm glad I don't work in this industry, because if I made a bourbon that was named after what my grandfather called me, little shit wouldn't sell as well.
Well,
I called him a few things a lot worse than that. But we, you know, when he was growing up, and my father called me a lot of stuff, it wasn't. When you make their, you know, the blood pressure blow, that's when you get all those good adjectives called. You know.
You actually grew up, and how long do we have left? Okay, so in kind of off topic here, but you actually grew up. One thing I've loved about the bourbon industry in general, even though Kentucky is making this massive impact on the globe, it's still a small town feel. And you actually grew up with a lot of other master distillers that are currently, right? You and Eddie grew up together. You guys used to run around and.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Eddie Russell from Wild Turkey. We, you know, our dads were like brothers. I always called Jimmy and, you know, Booker the elder statesman of the bourbon industry, along with Elmer T. Lee and Parker Beam. I mean, they, you know, they created these super premium bourbons and went on the road and promoted them and got everybody excited about bourbon. But, you know, the offspring, like Eddie and me, we were close with our fathers, and our fathers were so close that when there was events that we accompanied them to, we hung out because we were their sons, and we just kind of were, maybe they drove, we might have drove them there to wherever it was, or
and now that's happening with your sons,
all right,
Bruce and Freddie.
Bruce and Freddie. That was funny at Chicago Whiskey Fest last week. Bruce and Eddie and Jimmy were all there at the Wild Turkey booth, and I walked over there, and it was almost like one big family. We were laughing,
course.
You know, we were giving Bruce a hard time because he stayed out a little too late. I think the night before he was looking a little peaked, but then his cousin Joanne, she's in the business too. She hadn't showed up yet, but you know, Jimmy was covering for the granddaughter.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, she'll be here. She'll be here.
Yeah, yeah.
And Bruce was beating her up pretty hard. She knows what time it started. It's kind of funny, a little sibling rivalry within the family. But that's what we do. We give each other a hard time, but we all stand together. And
of course.
That's one thing, a unique thing about the bourbon industry is we are legitimately friends, and we do get along, and we have a lot of fun hanging out, which not many industries are like that. It's really cool.
So in my day job, I work for a company that deals a lot with so and why I'm getting off this is bourbon, like you said, even though you might be considered competitors, you're like a family. You guys are support mm-hmm. each other. You guys bring each other up. And I work in other industries. I work in another industry in which, and I won't mention the two names, but they're two soda companies where you're not allowed to when they do their travel and expense. That this these people, these employees, aren't allowed to stay at hotels that serve the other competitor's soda.
Mm. Wow!
So we have to look. You know, if you've got these executives traveling to Dubai or to some country in the Middle East, we've got to call around and find hotels who don't serve that soda beverage.
Yeah.
So it's the exact opposite for bourbon, where you guys all bring each other up. I just saw an article recently that talked about the torch being passed to Bruce and Freddie and mm-hmm. and the next generation to take over. I mean, you're in such a – and what a great time for them to be moving into these roles, because bourbon is on this massive upswing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it's great to set them up and to sit back and watch them. You know, I know when Dad kind of turned the reins over to me, he watched and was very proud to see that, because then you know it's in good hands. Going forward, and
of course,
what better hands going to be than your son that you've hopefully trained and raised upright? And we all kind of laugh about it, because you know all of our parents had doubts when we were younger.
Of course,
but we came around. You know, I had doubts on Freddie. I'll be honest; my dad had doubts on me, and I'm sure I know Uncle Jerry Beam had doubts on Booker.
Yeah,
but that's just we come around, and when you do, you know you grow up and you decide it's what you want to do, because it's not a 9-to-5 job, you know. It's a lifestyle, and you do it.
Oh, it's a completely consuming lifestyle. There's this perception with your children, even if they still look like children, where they're not quite ready for anything, right?
Right.
And whereas when someone looks at you, you've got this prestigious, like, I've been in this for 40 years or 50. How long have you been doing this?
34 years.
Where you look at Freddie and Bruce, they still look like kids. They still look like, you know.
I still call them kids because they always will be kids in my eyes. We laugh about it.
So they've got to fight that perception, but that's part of what shapes them into who they're going to be. And
right.
It's part of what shapes this industry is the torch has been passed. It's happening. And Little Book, what an honor, or what a exciting thing for him, for his first thing out the gate to be an explosive success.
Yeah.
So, Bruce, no pressure.
Bruce is working on some rides and things, I think. You know, Jimmy is mentoring Bruce. He's got him under his wing, and he's bringing him in. He's now at the distillery. We were laughing about it. Eddie, you know, laughs about it. Hey, Jimmy sent him to the warehouse rolling barrels. Bruce is sitting in Jimmy's office.
With his feet up.
Talking, talking to Mimmy. He calls him Mimmy. That's what he, well, I guess he called him when he was a little boy. And Jimmy is mentoring him on, and Rye is a big thing that Bruce really likes. So it's funny to watch these, like I say, kids, but they're coming into it, and they've got their own minds, and, you know, they're going to do their thing. And they'll do well. They'll do well.
We've got a couple seconds left, but I'll say this. Rye, I think, is the next. I think we're coming back. Rye was historically popular during Prohibition or in the olden days, you know, 60, 70 years ago. And I think we are moving towards a lot of bourbon drinkers love a good rye.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I think Bruce is onto something there.
Mm-hmm.
Don't stop. Keep going.
Oh, he will. They're doing well. They do make a good rye whiskey.
But these historically iconic brands branching outside their comfort zone is only going to lead to innovation. And the fact that it's the historical brands at the front of the innovation is a great thing for bourbon drinkers and the business alike.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, that's the thing. We've all got experience making rye whiskey. You know, Wild Turkey, Jimmy made rye for many years. It wasn't real popular. Dad made a lot of rye whiskey, but it didn't sell that much. So, I mean, we know how to do it. It's just now the demand curve is picking up.
Everyone's catching up. Mm-hmm. Right. So they were ahead of their time. You know, the early 2000s saw a lot of new vodkas coming out, a lot of peach this and flavored this. And I want to say gin was popular in the 50s and 60s. And so it seems like almost every decade or couple of decades, there's this new fad. And if to keep within the whiskey family, as opposed to changing spirits altogether, I think is a smart move. Bourbon's not going away. Definitely not.
No, no. We don't see any decline in
there's still room for that.
There's still plenty of room for that. But who doesn't love a good rye? Yeah. So with that, I really appreciate it. Fred, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Glad to be here, Chris.
Adam.
Chris, you got it, man.
Good seeing you again,
buddy. Thanks for having us.
I'll see you in June, July?
I plan to.
Plan to?
Yep.
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
See you later. Cheers.
Cheers.